Speaking of the Survivor Series, at that event at Hartford, the mystery partner of the million-dollar team, a man named Kane.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Greetings from Allentown is taped before a live studio audience.
Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 41 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winson, and today we'll be taking a look at WWF Superstars from December 1st, 1990. As you can hear, kind of the Ultimate Warriors theme in the background there. It was a very interesting intro that they were using at this time, even though it seemed like they were giving up on the Ultimate Warrior as being the top guy, they still made him the only focal point of the intro to the show, where they literally had lightning striking him from all sides and laser beams shooting out of his freaking eyes. So I don't understand what they were trying to do, other than maybe a graphics designer wanted to have some fun. And speaking of fun, the little distortion in the audio that you heard during the opening intro there was actually a reference to something that occurred 30 years ago yesterday as this show dropped. So it was November 22nd, 1987, where you had one of the most bizarre instances in television history, where Doctor Who is airing on some Chicago station, and all of a sudden, in the middle of the broadcast, Max Headroom appears on screen and says a bunch of stuff that you can't quite hear. It's on YouTube. It's pretty remarkable. Somebody has translated a lot of it. Because I remember Max Headroom most for like the Coke commercials and all that sort of stuff. But just kind of an interesting interlude in U.S. television history. So now that I got that out of the way, let me just get the plugs out of the way as well. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com. Facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. And on Twitter, @GFAllentownPod. I want to get to one thing from Twitter in the past week in just a moment. But, of course, you'll probably listen to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed in association with Place to Be Nation. And with the holidays coming up, help out Place to Be Nation with site costs and that sort of stuff by going to placetobenation.com/Amazon and doing your Amazon shopping through there, which is something that I did just the other day, making a purchase of wood chips for my Thanksgiving turkey, which I may even be enjoying right now as you're listening to this on Thursday, November 23rd. And I also bought soap for some reason. You know, normal people would buy soap at the store, you know, maybe a BJ's Wholesale, something like that. No, I'm just going to order it online because I had to get over $30 because of something about add-on items. I don't really care about the Amazon rules, but that's fine. So back to the Twitter thing. There was a very interesting thing that I want to call attention to on Twitter that was quite fun from MLJ on Twitter. And it was, which wrestling show have you watched the most in your lifetime? And immediately, my thought process on that question is, it's probably something from the first year, year and a half that you were watching wrestling and you had on tape. So it would be one of the first tapes that you had. My first tape was WrestleMania 4. But because that was a four-hour thing and it involved two tapes, you got to take one out, put another one in, I did not watch that one as much. So my number one was the 1988 Survivor Series, which, of course, the Survivor Series this past Sunday for WWE, the 31st edition of that. And 1988 would have been the second one. And I always enjoyed that show for the sheer randomness throughout. It's only four matches. It's very, very easy to get through. A lot of fun promo stuff along the way. It's a definite number one for me. Number two would be the 1992 Royal Rumble, which I usually just watch the Rumble match at this point, but I do watch the whole show on a fairly regular basis. And then for number three, Emma was not asking for the top three, but I had to put in the top three because of my number three thing, which was the episode of the Bobby Heenan show where the porn star Heather Hunter does a striptease for him. I feel like that's the third most common wrestling thing that I've ever watched. So he's a very good follow on Twitter. So if I could remember the handle name right now, I would shout it out. But you just look up MLJ on Twitter. It's fine. So I had a fun experience in an indie show this past week on Friday night. And I have to give a thank you to Mike Crockett of the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing for hooking me up with a ticket to Chaotic Wrestling in Woburn last Friday night. And I have to share my story of everything that kind of went on there. And I love the venue there. It's the Elks Club in Woburn, where I grew up in Massachusetts. And my father was a member of the Elks, although he wouldn't hang out there very much. He was a member, but it's not like he would go there and hang out and drink or anything, because he didn't really drink at all. So they had a show there, and it's not one of their big shows, but you know, it's their monthly show. They come to Woburn, I think, four or five times a year, and I've been to shows there about five or six times. It, you know, occasionally they'll bring in a huge name. I know they had Cody Rhodes in earlier. Am I allowed to say Cody Rhodes? Should I check with somebody on that? Well, whatever. This show, you know, had some good matches on it. There was a problem, though, for me, and it had nothing to do with the parking in the venue, because they had an event going on downstairs. So somebody's bar mitzvah is going on downstairs, or I don't know what it was. And then upstairs you have wrestling going on. And, you know, four matches before the intermission, I was, you know, it was a good take. I like being around a variety of people at one of these shows and kind of taking it in. Like, to my left, I had the guy wearing the Nakamura Strong Style shirt, who's just instantly cynical about everything and just kind of like goes, you know, to like literally everything that happens. And to my right, I have this woman who's probably about 45 or 50 years old, and she is screaming for everything, like keeping it 100% kayfabe. And I like the mix of those two, just kind of being in the middle of it all. So I did not stay for the entire show, and I should explain why. It would have something to do with the fact that I was completely exhausted from staying up till 1:30 in the morning all week watching Boston Bruins games playing on the West Coast, and that was only a part of it. But I had a bit of an issue. On an earlier episode, I had said that I wish I could go to more indie shows, except my wife travels a lot for work, and I often have to pick her up at the airport on Friday night when these shows might be. Well, this time, she was flying to a different airport, and her car was there. So I thought, well, this is great. I can go to this show, whatever. Well, her birthday is actually today, and I had ordered her present, and it was going to arrive at the house on Friday. And I got confirmation that it did arrive. And I realized when I was at the show that, oh my God, she's going to get back from the airport and she's going to see the package out there and it's going to give away the whole present. So that was another motivation why I left at the end of intermission, where I was kind of like walking around there and, you know, just kind of taking it in. It was really weird seeing my dad's name on the in memoriam in the Woburn Elks, because of all the shows that I've been there, I've never gone into that little room where all the gimmick tables are, basically. So I leave, I go to my car, and I had stuff to mail and all sorts of things. And I rush to get home, but the problem is I get to the post office to mail the thing, and I look at my phone. My wife says, my flight has been delayed several hours getting to Manchester, so I'm flying into Boston instead. So now I am halfway between Boston and my home, and I have to drive home, get there, open the present, hide it somewhere, and then turn around, drive 45 minutes back to the airport and pick her up, which is exactly what I did. So in terms of my tiredness, it did not really do much for that, but you know, it's fine. And oddly enough, she'll be flying. I have to pick her up from the airport at the next after the next chaotic show on December 8th, which luckily for me is in Lowell, so it's much closer to home for me, and I look forward to getting out to that. Although it's on the other side of Lowell, it's kind of in a weird spot, just across the Rourke Bridge. I know nobody cares about my Lowell references, so. Yeah, so good time at the Chaotic Show. Like I said, I want to say thanks to Mike Crockett on that one and my fun experiences on Friday night. So, December 1st, 1990, WWF Superstars. This is on the heels of the Survivor Series, which is something that I ordered on pay-per-view after a lengthy break in 1990. I wasn't out on wrestling, but I was not religiously devoted to watching every single week. And in looking back, I was 11 that summer. I didn't have anything else better going on. I don't know what I was doing that was any better than watching pro wrestling on a week-to-week basis. I think that was the summer that I was going to a lot of baseball card shows. Which I think they still have those, but like I would go to these shows and it would be this thing that my dad would enjoy because he would go and he would go up to the table and he would buy like some jabroni 1950s player that he inexplicably liked that they're selling the card for like a dollar. And I'm going around looking for like Ken Griffey Jr. cards because that's what people did when they were my age at the time. So that's what I'm doing in 1990 instead of watching wrestling, although I was still following it. But deep down, I think part of it was that I simply refused at the time to take Ultimate Warrior as my top guy, with Hogan knocked down a peg after losing. Although I didn't order WrestleMania 6, which I don't understand why I didn't get that show, because it's very fun on the rewatches, and I really enjoy seeing it. I probably watched it 3 or 4 times since I got the network 3 years ago. But for whatever reason, I just wasn't watching it. Like, oh, Brutus Beefcake, he's hurt and he's out. I don't remember how I found out about that. It was probably from the wrestling magazines, which I was also picking up from time to time. But really kind of an interesting year for the WWF. A lot of fun stuff happening. And then in the Survivor Series, I came back because of the egg. Yes, I am one of the people who ordered the show because of the egg. I wanted to know what was in that damn egg. And we're going to get a visit from the Gobbledygooker on this episode of WWF Superstars. And I have to go into this because a lot of people, oh, this the character sucked, it was so stupid, blah, blah, blah. It's a little bit deeper than that, okay? There was something that they were trying to accomplish, and they were trying to do it in a pro wrestling way, but it failed because they were approaching it from a pro wrestling perspective, and had they done it a little different. And I'll get into that when we get our visit from the Gobbledygooker. But we also get an update on Kane the Undertaker, which that was something I heard about in like my college years in the late 90s. Like, oh yeah, he was originally Kane the Undertaker. And of course this coincided with Kane coming in and being the brother of the Undertaker. And he's still being referred to as Kane the Undertaker at this time, which is pretty much like one cycle of tapings where they refer to him as that. And at Survivor Series, DiBiase just refers to him as The Undertaker. So did they decide, okay, we're only going to call him The Undertaker now? That's fine. But, you know, Okerlund has that in the update. But in ring, we have some guys that I haven't either talked about in a while or that I've never talked about at all, like the Orient Express. And this would be the Akio Sato version, as Paul Diamond has not shown up in a mask now to kind of freshen up that team. Tugboat is in action as well. And Ted DiBiase is taking on a very interesting character. And the Texas Tornado is in our opening match here against the Brooklyn Brawler. Show was actually taped several weeks before the Survivor Series on October 29th, 1990. It was actually the last Superstars from this taping. And it was done at the Market Square Arena in Indianapolis, Indiana, which from a wrestling perspective is most certainly most famous for being the site of the Hulk Hogan Andre the Giant main event match from February of 1988. So with all that in mind, why don't we just jump right into the show? Sure, you know that earlier this week we lost Malcolm Young, one of the greatest guitarists of all time, Chris, from AC/DC, a band whose music gets me fired up for pretty much any occasion. So they're going to be the bumpers on all of today's show as a result. Vince, in the intro here, they're not really doing that thing where Vince tells us what's going on in the town that they're doing the show from anymore. But Market Square Arena is also famous, not only for the Hogan Andre thing, but it was the last show for Elvis Presley before he died in 1977. So, of course, that arena is no longer in existence. It is replaced by the Conseco Fieldhouse for the Indiana Pacers. It's probably called something else, but I'm just going to go with what I remember it as anyway. So our first bout here is the Texas Tornado, Kerry Von Erich, and his atrocious music. Still with the Intercontinental Championship belt, although that would not be for long, and it was kind of in a weird state at this time. He's taking on the Brooklyn Brawler. So he had lost the Intercontinental title by this point, by the time this show aired on December 1st. In fact, he had even lost it before the Survivor Series. And that taping took place a couple of days before the Survivor Series on November 19th, but it would not air until December 15th. So he's still carrying the belt here. He carries it through the Survivor Series, which I put myself in the shoes of somebody who attended that taping on November 19th, and they see this guy lose the belt, but then when they see the pay-per-view a few days later, he still has the belt on. I'm not sure if they work something in the arena to kind of explain that, but then you also have The Undertaker working a match, which might have spoiled the whole notion of the mystery partner of Ted DiBiase, although apparently it was originally going to be Bad News Brown, but he had left the company by that taping and wasn't on TV anymore. So the Tornado's IC title reign here, we can kind of, this is kind of the coda for it. You don't see him again on TV defending the belt successfully, which this is billed as a title match and everything that I've seen. It's like, oh, okay, so what did the Brawler do to earn a shot here? And it made me think, okay, on the Tornado, WWF deserves a lot of credit for the period from 79 through 1992, there were not very many singles title reigns that you would classify even as disappointments or disasters. I mean, that seems like something that's more frequent these days. Maybe some disappointment with Jinder Mahal holding the WWE Championship, although there's a case to be made for the fact that it elevated him somewhat, although there was probably a way to maybe build him up a little bit more beforehand, but that's neither here nor there. You take that earlier period there of 13 years, which covers the first 13 years of the Intercontinental title from Pat Patterson through the world title is easy. You can remember every WWF world champion like right off the top of your head for the first 30-something years of the promotion. We're talking Backlund, And then Iron Sheik for a few weeks, onto Hogan, and then you get it held up after all that. Then you get Savage, back to Hogan. There's nobody in that role that was a miserable failure. Unless you want to penalize Bob Backlund in 1983, and even then, it's not like he was killing business, it's just that they weren't getting the reactions for him that they once were, which was partly because they just run out of people by 1983 for Backlund to face. So put aside the world title, and we're going to put aside the tag team titles as well, because I want to focus on singles titles, because there are only two of them there in WWF. So the Intercontinental title, did anybody have a more disastrous or disappointing reign than the Texas Tornado? You had Mr. Perfect, who only held it for a very brief period up to the point where you had the tournament after WrestleMania 6 up through SummerSlam. I would not call that necessarily a failure in any way. Before that, you had the Warrior twice with Rick Rude in the middle. I feel like both of those are definitely better reigns than what you had from Texas Tornado. Then you go back to Honky Tonk Man, which everybody kind of wants to, oh, I hated that guy. Well, that was the point, okay? This is a guy who could headline B shows, and people would go to these shows because they wanted to see him die. They wanted to see Jake or Hacksaw Jim Duggan or Savage or anybody just beat the holy hell out of him and take his title. And so that made him an effective champion. Ricky Steamboat was only a disappointment in so much as they clearly wanted to have him have a longer reign than the 9 or so weeks between WrestleMania 3 and the Honky Tonk Man. But at the end of the day, it probably worked out the best to get the title back onto a heel, because you have a babyface as your main champion, and then you can have the babyfaces underneath chasing the Intercontinental title. If you're only going to have two titles, you have to have it split out, I think it's best, between a babyface and a heel, because at least it provides a goal for everybody on the roster. Sure, everybody wants to be the world champion, but you're not going to have a babyface match unless it's something truly special like you had with the Hogan Warrior thing. And going back before Honky and Steamboat, you have Savage, of course, was probably the greatest one that there ever was, certainly top three. And then Santana with two reigns before that, and Valentine in both solid matches all during their respective reigns. And really, you have to go back to Don Morocco in 1983, and I'm not sure I would rank that necessarily below Kerry Von Erich, the Texas Tornado in 1990, who certainly had his problems, and they're well documented. I don't even have to go into the kind of issues that the Tornado was going through because of his motorcycle accident years before. I mean, that's just well traveled ground there. Now, as for Tornado's IC title reign and who he might have faced during it, it was basically just the Mr. Perfect program. It's not like he faced other fresh opponents after getting the belt. Generally, the way it went was he would lose via countout, or it would be a double countout, but then he would pick up a few wins against Mr. Perfect before eventually dropping the belt back to when I said he did. But it was kind of strange. There's like some matches in there where He's facing Mr. Perfect with Roddy Piper as a special referee. And I don't quite understand how Piper got worked into that mix, because it was something that never aired on television, including a match that really stands out on the history of WWE.com, but is not listed on the cage match page for either Perfect or Piper from the November 20th, 1990 Wrestling Challenge taping in Syracuse, where Mr. Perfect defeats Roddy Piper clean with the Perfect Plex, and then Piper shakes his hand after the match. That's something that I want to be on a future version of Unreleased, and unfortunately it was not on the last one, because Piper losing cleanly like that just seems really kind of mind-blowing. So yeah, the tornado. I don't quite understand what they were trying to do. Maybe it was done to try and keep him in line. The thought was, well, if we give him the belt, perhaps this will keep him on the straight and narrow. Maybe we want to relive 1984 for whatever reason. Like I've said many times on this show in the past, you can't look back. It's easy to look back and to, you know, try and recapture something that happened to a guy before. And yes, you can reuse storylines and angles all you want, but to recapture a moment with a specific guy is really just kind of a fool's errand to try and do that. So the brawler tries a cheap shot on the ropes there, which ends up getting blocked. And, you know, I mentioned Brawler last week on the WCW Prime show, which seemed like a kind of an odd time to be talking about Steve Lombardi, but he's a very good company man. You don't stick around in the business in the role that he had for as long as he did, but, sir, you are no Mark Starr. Let me tell you that right now. Piper suggests that you should never break clean on the ropes, which I thought was a very interesting sentiment.
When you are in competition, and you are in the pros, we're not here to get points, and you're breaking on the ropes so nice, and you know what you're dealing with, is that really the smart thing to do? Is it smart to give a guy an inch when you know he's going to take it?
And that kind of goes back to the whole Piper as a commentator in 1990 being different than he was the following year, were slightly more heel tendencies, not quite Jesse Ventura, but he was not happy-go-lucky babyface, let's go Virgil, go get him kind of guy that he was in 1991. It almost seems like he was going for some kind of heelish edge that never quite materialized. They talked about, you know, Piper perhaps having a heel run in 1992, and if he had decided to continue after WrestleMania 8, I do think that if he had tried to turn heel at this point, it would have been bad, because then you don't have him to get Virgil over in 1991. You don't have him in there with DiBiase. And I don't think it would have worked quite as well at that time. But I do kind of enjoy the sort of tweener commentary, although he does get on some people's nerves, although he gets on my nerves a little bit more in 91, although I enjoy his banter with Bobby Heenan at SummerSlam 1991, which at some points cuts a little too close. You can sort of tell by the way they're talking to each other. Kerry does not look completely terrible here, but he's keeping it really simple with just a lot of punches, really. And one of them actually causes the brawler to bend over in the middle of the ring, which I'm going to leave alone, okay? Lombardi was a company man. He did what he had to do to survive, and I'm just gonna say that. And the discus punch finishes, which is just a stupid move. I hate... Look, I know it's hypocritical of me to pick and choose which sort of punch moves that I am going to accept. Like, why is Ronnie Garvin's Hands of Stone acceptable? Because for some reason it makes me feel awesome watching it. Why does Roman Reigns' Superman punch bother me? Because It just does. Nobody throws a punch like that except for Kevin Bieksa in the NHL, and that guy sucks because he's a complete spot picker who won't fight anybody tougher than him. All right, so yeah, I choose Johnny B. Badd because he was an actual boxer, so I accepted it then. But this discus punch business, come on, I mean. I know that the claw was certainly out of style, and he would bring that out from time to time. In fact, used it against Dino Bravo in WrestleMania 7. But, yeah, discus punch, maybe should have found something else there. Maybe just have it be like a big lariat or something. He, you know, he's from Texas. It would have worked. Just no discus punch, please. I feel like Hell's Bells is an appropriate song leading into the update segment, since it'll be on Kane the Undertaker, which they didn't seem like they could make up their minds quite yet at this point. Oakland tells us that Survivor Series 1990 is coming on VHS from Coliseum Home Video on December 20th, so the turnaround time on these tapes is less than I remember it being. For some reason, I remember it being 2 months, but only a month for this one. They probably sped it up over time, and by that point, I wasn't buying the commercial VHS tapes, because I, as I explained in an earlier episode, my parents would get me the pay-per-views, figuring that it was cheaper to just tape the pay-per-view rather than to buy the commercial tape. And that would eventually change over time as pay-per-views got more expensive. But by then, I really wasn't getting them anymore. So this is a quick review of Kane the Undertaker's performance at the Survivor Series. Now, Oakland is referring to him as that name through this entire thing. But when you go to the footage from the Survivor Series, of course, as I said, DiBiase refers to him as The Undertaker. But I don't think he messed up, because when Finkel says that he's been counted out, which I'll get to in a second because there's a whole bunch of issues there, he says The Undertaker has been counted out, not Kane The Undertaker. So it makes me wonder, when did they tape this update segment with Okerlund where he's constantly using the name Kane? Is this a case of the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing at the WWF? Is this a WCW-type moment for them? We'll probably never know, because if you asked somebody, hey, do you remember when, you know, if you asked Oakland, do you remember when you taped that thing where you kept saying Kane the Undertaker? You just look at you like you're crazy. I mean, who's going to really remember that stuff after 27 years? Oakland mentions the Undertaker and refers to him as a man named Kane, which I liked so much. I played it at the top of the show before the intro, and it just makes me think of the how The Undertaker and Sting were linked together for so long, and it was something of a dream match, and those two guys would never meet up in a WWE ring because it just wasn't going to work. The guys were too old by the time Sting finally made the leap. But the way Okerlund said it just made me think of maybe a theme song like Sting's theme for The Undertaker. Man named Kane! Man named Kane! Yeah, that probably wouldn't have worked. So as I said, one taping for Kane The Undertaker that he did matches at where he was announced as that. And they show highlights of his debut with DiBiase's introduction. And as he's coming down the aisle, I have to credit them for a great camera shot, which is often shown in those Best of Undertaker montages and all that, where the guy, he's going backwards up the aisle, and he's shooting straight up, basically from Undertaker's shins, to kind of give us the impression of how big this guy is. And Piper and Gorilla estimate him at about 6'8", 6'9". He's billed at 328, or actually 320, from Death Valley, because they didn't fill DiBiase in on the weights, so he had him only at 320 instead of 328, or maybe Undertaker gained a little weight later on. Who knows? Maybe he lost weight down in WCW as Mean Mark. Maybe they just didn't have the kind of food backstage that would cause him to put on those 8 pounds. So the Undertaker, he just kind of cuts through guys in that match, as you remember, with Coco being eliminated via tombstone, and a pretty stiff-looking tombstone where he's spiked away from the hard camera. I don't know if that was on purpose or not, but Undertaker's early tombstones were a little bit sloppy-looking, in my opinion. And then they cut to him eliminating Dusty. They don't show him pinning Dusty, which was done by him going to the top rope, throwing a clothesline after walking across the ropes, a la the spoiler. They only show Dusty getting thrown over the top rope, at which point Brother Love starts laying the boots to him. Undertaker had tagged out of the match, which is important because when Dusty recovers and starts going after Brother Love for telling that story again about the second most recognized athlete in the world, as told on that Bruce Pritchard podcast way back when, Undertaker goes and gets him. They announce that he's been counted out, even though he's not the legal man, which is, I don't know, kind of ruins the match for me, because something really got screwed up there. You don't need, he could just have to go backstage because he's got to pee or something. Does he get counted out if he leaves because he has to go pee? And that's a real oversight right there. In fact, it kind of ruined the show for me. I'm really just kidding with that. That match as a whole, and I kind of want to talk about the greater Survivor Series as I go through this show. It's kind of my sneaky way of talking about pay-per-views without actually reviewing the whole pay-per-view. This is, of course, the match that Bret Hart dedicated to his brother Dean. And it was Bret Hart who was the first one in the ring with The Undertaker. So for the record, that was Undertaker's first contact in a WWF ring. And Bret lasted until the very end of the match before falling to Ted DiBiase and memorably sitting up after the pin and yelling as loud as he can, "Fuck!" to the camera, which gets bleeped on the network because you can just clearly hear it from the original pay-per-view broadcast. And also, it's very strange seeing The Undertaker teaming with the Honky Tonk Man and black hair Greg Valentine for his debut. It seems like something so out of place. And I watched this match, had to have been about 1 in the morning last Saturday night. It was really late at night. I don't know what night of the week it was, but it was an obscene hour. And it was, you know, this is the last match where Valentine, at least on a major stage, where Valentine has the black hair and Gorilla calls him Boxcar. And I'm so addled, I'm so tired. I started cracking up at Gorilla calling Greg Valentine Boxcar. It's not the best look there for Valentine. But this update segment is also notable for something else, as this is, of course, the first time you would ever hear The Undertaker speak on WWF television, as he's there with Brother Love, and here's what the two of them had to say.
Surprise, surprise! Take a look, brothers and sisters of the WWF! Take a good look! 7 feet straight up, and Kane, The Undertaker!
I'm here to do what I do best, and that's to bury any man that gets in my way.
By stating that he was willing to bury any guy who got in his way, The Undertaker, right from the very start, was showing from all perspectives why he had what it takes to be a top guy in professional wrestling. Money Talks is really the only appropriate AC/DC song for the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, who is taking on Jim Evans here. And Jim Evans is a very plain name. Kind of sounds like one of the guys who could have been a quarterback for the Browns at some point in the last 15 or 20 years since their re-entry into the NFL in 1999. But no, Jim Evans is more known for something else. And I'm not talking about his tag team with Richard Sartain as the Rock and Roll Rebels in Deep South Wrestling in the late 1980s. Oh, no. He is much more famous for being Ding Dong Number One. Yes, this is one of the two guys, along with Sartain, who were put under mask by Jim Herd in 1989 WCW as the Ding Dongs, and they would ring a bell. And it really, I can find a silver lining in just about anything. Like, okay, here's what they were trying to do. You're going to see that a little bit later when I talk about Gobbledygooker. But the Ding Dongs are one of those things that just was completely idiotic from the start. The idea, of course, that Jim Herd had was, let's have a family-friendly team, somebody that the kids could get behind, kind of like what the Bushwhackers are in the WWF. Maybe we can sell some merchandise or whatever. But the Ding Dongs is literally one of the stupidest things that anybody could have ever come up with. And they debuted on Clash of the Champions 7, and if I ever do a Clash of the Champions, it'll probably be that one, because if I'm home and I feel like watching something and getting drunk, Clash of the Champions 7 is like my show that I like to watch and get drunk to, because the whole audience, which is military servicemen who don't give a crap what's going on here, they're all loaded. They're in a building where it's like 99 degrees Fahrenheit inside with no AC. It's really an insane show. I cannot recommend it highly enough that you go and watch Clash of the Champions 7. But right now we have DiBiase and Virgil. And this is about 6 weeks before their split at Royal Rumble 1991. And this is before they started really beating us over the head with the Virgil is being mistreated thing. The only kind of incident that they had at Survivor Series was Virgil failed to hold Bret Hart, and Virgil got knocked off the apron by DiBiase and nearly got rolled up for a pin. But that really, I don't think, was the start of it. They started having vignettes shortly after this where Virgil would have to clean DiBiase's shoes that had cow dung on them or horse dung or something. He would also have to pick the fungus out of DiBiase's toes. All sorts of really over-the-top, disgusting things that fit perfectly with the DiBiase is a true dick character. And you'll notice on his way to the ring here, Virgil wipes his eye. I don't think anybody spit on him at that show. But is Virgil trying to like subtly like wipe away a tear or something? If so, that's the most subtle storyline acting ever, and it's friggin' Virgil. How is that even possible? But here's the thing with Ted DiBiase, okay? You know, he never won a singles title in the WWF, but they always gave him something to do. When one storyline would end, like his like the thing at WrestleMania 6 with Jake the Snake, he would have another thing start up with the Boss Man right away. When the thing with Dusty ends at Royal Rumble 91, you have the Virgil thing that gets kicked. They always had something for him to do. Which, yes, part of it is that character is, if you're in creative, the Million Dollar Man, and just Ted DiBiase's talents in general, the Million Dollar Man, just as a character, you can put anybody in that role, is very, very easy to write for. It's very easy to envision scenarios and to write creative for a guy like that. And that's certainly, you know, a nice little benefit to have. But also having a guy like Ted DiBiase in the role certainly does not hurt at all. Here he gets a pile driver early and tosses Evans over the top rope. And we get an inset promo from the Million Dollar Man. And he, once again, it's another one of those inconsistencies that's driving me crazy here.
At the Survivor Series, I promised you a surprise. And oh, what a surprise! Kane the Undertaker. Once again, the Million Dollar Man has illustrated the power of his enormous wealth. Kane the Undertaker will wreak havoc on the World Wrestling Federation.
Yeah, I give up. I guess they couldn't really make up their mind or something there. And another thing is that I would often see the spelling of Kane, because Meltzer in The Observer, when he was talking about Kane in 1997 before he would appear on screen, the spelling of it would alternate between the one that we know, which is K-A-N-E, of course, and C-A-I-N, which is the Cain from the Bible, which you would think it would be like that, but I think Cain with a K is a better name. Now, for those of you unfamiliar with the biblical implications of Cain, let me just, you know, give you a refresher on this. The Cain in the Old Testament, this is Cain with a C, firstborn son of Adam and Eve, who murdered his brother Abel. Cain is a farmer, became enraged when the Lord accepted the offering of his brother Abel, a shepherd, in preference to his own. He murdered Abel and was banished by the Lord from the settled country. So yes, the WWF inadvertently, you know, going biblical there. Virgil, not a biblical figure, merely a wrestling superstar. You can see him outside the ring, and he's looking very, very moody, even for Virgil. Very, very subtle as well. You really kind of have to pick up and notice it. It's a very nuanced performance by Mike Jones here. A round of applause. Virgil, he was never better than at this point, I guess. Ted goes for the pin, but does that dick move where he pulls the guy up at two, which is usually enjoyable, at least in jobber matches. When the heel does it, in a match against a name guy, it always means he ends up losing in the next 3 minutes. But in a jobber match like this, I can deal with it. And he locks on the million-dollar dream, and a referee calls for the bell. So it's not Jim Evans calling for the bell like in his ding-dongs days, but yes, he has fallen in this one to Ted's finishing hold. Now, DiBiase, it's so efficient here. Rather than giving the guys the payoff in the back, you know, behind closed doors, it's very nice of him to just deliver the payoff straight into the guy's mouth after he's defeated him. I feel like that would be funny if they did that for, like, other guys' matches, too. Where, like, Dino Bravo beats some guy with a side suplex and he shoves, like, $15 in cash. Maybe a toonie or something in there. Like, I don't know. It's why Ted, I think, was such a good guy for jobbers to face. Him and Beefcake, because at least with Beefcake, they get a free haircut. With Jake, they would get the snake thrown on him, but they get a little bit of extra cash thrown their way. And yes, it is my understanding that they would be able to keep the $100. Now, I don't know if it would get taken out of their pay on the back, but hey, you're getting paid in cash. I mean, the guy, DiBiase, he was like a one-man stimulus program for his WWF run.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Now, once again, courtesy of Coliseum Home Video, distributor of the Survivor Series, we have the debut of the Gobbledygooker, which, again, well-traveled ground in wrestling circles, wrestle crap, and this and that kind of stuff. And in the footage that they show here, it is a little bit different from what you saw on the original Survivor Series because the crowd is sweetened like crazy. So you're probably thinking, well, Pete's going to go crazy about this because he went crazy about them changing the audio of Sid and Hogan at the 92 Royal Rumble. Now, I'm going to consider this a little bit different because it's not changing an active storyline. It's just taking a moment in time and trying to make it a little bit more popular than it was. And quite frankly, it was embarrassing for them to have it not turn out the way that they thought it would. But, you know, we all remember Wildcat Willie in WCW. Oh, wait, you don't remember Wildcat Willie? Wildcat Willie was a mascot that they had from 1995 up to around the point where Scott Steiner beat the hell out of him on a Nitro, which I think was December of 1998. Just kind of a mascot that would go around and, you know, do tricks and all that, you know, flips and whatever. Sort of like what the Gobbledygooker was doing in the ring. Sort of acrobatics to entertain the crowd during the slow points. It's similar to what the Nitro Girls were doing. So let's rewind to the point where I'm watching this as an 11-year-old. Because as I said, I got the show because I wanted to see what was in the egg. And when this came out of the egg, obviously I was disappointed. But if I were to just say that and say, oh, the Gobbledygooker sucked, it would just make me like everybody else out there. I can't really defend the Gobbledygooker, so perhaps an examination here is needed. And maybe it's a desire to be fair to mascots, because in general, I like mascots. They play an important role in certain areas of life. I've worn a mascot uniform. I've dressed up in some, I think it was like a bear costume or something, and stood outside the PetSmart that I worked at and waved at traffic, which isn't exactly the greatest gig in the world. I remember the giant bear head came with a little tiny fan on the inside that really didn't do anything. So it was incredibly hot to be in that thing. Although it was certainly better than when they had me dress up as Santa Claus and people would bring in their animals and some ferret pissed on me when, but who brings their ferret to get their picture taken with Santa Claus? Which, by the way, they didn't even give me a pillow, so I wasn't even a fat Santa Claus. I was like the thinnest Santa Claus on record, and I'm not exactly a slim, trim guy. Anyway, back to gobbledygooker here. You know, I have respect for the uniform. I'm not one of those people that's going to throw stuff at a mascot. I've participated in mascot pranks at a Chicago Blackhawks game that I went to about 9 years ago. So, you know, fine. You gotta have respect for the uniform there. There are certainly several arguments in favor of having a mascot in WWF and rolling one out at that time. One being that it is a more kid-friendly promotion, as I had mentioned before, with the Bushwhackers and all that. But it probably would have been better to do it a couple of years even before this. And the idea itself is not completely terrible. So let's run down some of the cons we have here. Number one, the costuming of the gobbledygooker is pretty bad. A turkey is not something that is supposed to be friendly or anything like that. Like, when he comes out of the egg, Gorilla and Piper are immediately like, "What is that? I don't know what that is." You should be able to at least identify what it is right away. And considering that they were on Thanksgiving, they could probably figure out that it was a turkey. But as I said last week, turkeys are assholes. They are some of the meanest creatures out there. If you come across a wild turkey, they're not gonna be nice to you. It's like in the old Hanna-Barbera cartoons when they used to make hyenas like the friends of people. It's like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, why do you have a turkey as the mascot here? Unless you're trying to make it the mascot of the Survivor Series, which seems kind of dumb to have a mascot for a once-a-year event. So the costuming really doesn't help because there's just too much going on there. And even if you put him in a turkey outfit that looks more straight up like a turkey, it just doesn't work. So find another animal to dress up the mascot as, maybe even as like a comic book character or something. It doesn't really matter. Number two, this gobbledygooker was the victim of a great build. It's undeniable to say the build to it was great. It made me want to see the pay-per-view. It made me want to see what was going to come out of that egg. And it would be a good way to debut a new wrestler if you did it correctly, because you have all eyeballs on it. You have people anticipating that moment. It was really too good for what the result ended up being. They used an effective tool within the world of wrestling, but it was too effective for what they had. Number three, the name of the mascot. And generally, naming a mascot shouldn't be too difficult. It should be kept simple. Like, the mascot of the Boston Bruins is named Blades because, you know, they have skate blades underneath. You know, there are other mascots in hockey like Slapshot. The Slider is the name of one of the mascots in Major League Baseball. You should keep it simple. Gobbledygooker just sounds like a stupid name. It feels like something that when you say it, you make a face at the end of it, like gobbledygooker, like a face of disgust and not one that would make you smile. Like when I say Mario Lopez, every time I'm smiling at the end. Oh wait, that's not a mascot character? I could have sworn. But yeah, gobbledygooker is another example of one of those things that, well, Vince McMahon finds it funny, so that's what we're going to go with here. So is there a way that they could have made this thing work? A better idea would have been to do something similar to like what you'd see with a restaurant having a soft opening, where they're open to the public before their grand opening. What I mean by that is you roll out this mascot character at house shows, and you kind of introduce him slowly that way. And then maybe you throw the mascot on the weekly TV in a quick little 15, 30-second segment to quickly introduce it that way. Maybe doing pratfalls around the ring, stuff like that, to kind of introduce the audience. By putting it on that big of a stage, there where people are paying money to see pro wrestling on pay-per-view and to have their time, I guess, wasted by this 10-minute thing where he's dancing around with Gene Okerlund in the ring, and Okerlund's making bad jokes like, oh, you got legs like my mother-in-law. Like, you know, that's not exactly what people wanted to see. It's something you could have incorporated in the build-up to it, or, you know, you just don't have the egg to begin with. But again, it probably got people to buy the pay-per-view, so maybe it was a net positive. At the end of the day, you had suckers like me who hadn't gotten a pay-per-view since the Royal Rumble who are now back in the door because of that. Now, I had seen years later another example of a mascot unveiling gone wrong. And that was when the Boston Red Sox, you know, a franchise that had been around for almost 100 years at that point, 1997, decided to have a mascot for the first time in 1997. So they unveil Wally the Green Monster, a very, I guess, popular figure these days, 20 years later. But it was not always that way, as I was there at Fenway Park in April of 97 when they had the birth of Wally, and they did not exactly roll him out the correct way either, as they had a grand ceremony before the game where the mascot was going to come out of the wall, but they decided to have then very unpopular general manager Dan Duquette lead this long preambled introduction. And Dan Duquette, not exactly a dynamic speaker by any means. So Wally comes out of the left field wall and waves to the fans and gets booed vociferously. Eventually just kind of puts his head down and walks off the field. Not dissimilar to Homer Simpson when he goes to Capital City and people are just, you know, not buying his act at all. And it took several years of rehabilitation to make that mascot character work in a, you know, traditional franchise like the Boston Red Sox. WWF did not have time to do something like that with the gobbledygooker. And in any event, for reasons that I said, like the costuming and just the whole notion of a turkey being one of our best friends, the whole idea was just not going to work. And was it one of the worst things that in wrestling history? Is it legitimate wrestle crap? Yes, it probably is. But, you know, there is a way that they could have done it, but they just kind of did everything wrong, some of it by accident and some of it clearly on purpose. A long way to the top for the franchise Shane Douglas, who is not a franchise at this point. If he was one, he would probably be something along the lines of Sbarro, which we saw him eating alongside Johnny Ace in episode 25 during that Dynamic Dudes video vignette where they're buying skateboards and all that other stuff. But that's in the past. He's got a fresh start here in the WWF, taking on Iron Mike Sharp, a guy who is very familiar with fresh starts, as he would shower for hours on end due to his OCD that they would allude to on commentary from time to time. Shane here, he would usually wear colorful tights. In the 1991 Royal Rumble, I believe he wore something of a pinkish sort of tights there. And here, he's showing that he is a member in good standing of the Jimmy Garvin Appreciation Society, wearing the white trunks. I don't know if he's trying to impress Jim Barnett, but he's not there anymore. So I don't know who you're trying to get over with. Shane was in the first Greetings from Allentown match that I reviewed in the very first episode, as his real name, Troy Martin, taking on King Harley Race on a 1986 episode of Superstars. Go back in the archives and check that one out. Shane's 1990-91 WWF run, it always comes off as really bizarre, as sort of just a moment in time where you see him there and you're like, huh, Well, what was he doing here? Like, what would have come out of it? Because they did push him pretty well on commentary in the 91 Royal Rumble. Sure, he didn't eliminate anybody, but he was in there for about 25 minutes, which I always think kind of is one of those things where it's not really helpful. If you're there for a long time, but you don't exactly eliminate anybody or do anything, it doesn't really help you, I think, in the long run. But one thing in looking at his, you know, tenure during this time, one of the more notable things is that when Shawn Michaels suffered an injury in the middle of 1990, he was subbing for, which just seems so weird, Shane Douglas substituting for Shawn Michaels, given the history between those two guys that would later develop. And he's working alongside Marty Jannetty in kind of a remade version of the Rockers. So the thought is, well, what might have happened with him over time? Would he have become a rock star character? Well, one blog that I've read called Ring the Damn Bell, there's had a number of different blogs that I've read over time with some interesting thoughts and viewpoints and research and all that, suggested that he might have had a different version of what became the Heartbreak Kid gimmick a couple of years down the line. And I could see that given his experience in the Dynamic Dudes, and it would have been an interesting sort of thing to see Shane Douglas in sort of a rock star gimmick, as long as you don't have him sing or play guitar, because that's probably asking a little bit too much. I mean, they can't all be Elias Sampson, in my opinion. But he did leave for the right reasons, to care for his ill father. The problem was, while he didn't burn a bridge in leaving the way he did, because he just sort of turned up in WCW several months to a year down the road, yeah, he leaves for the right reasons, but he kind of singed a bridge there, because I'm pretty sure that they were not happy after letting the guy go to take care of his father, and then he shows up in the other promotion down the road after they didn't put too much into him, but they put a little bit into him. So, and you know, that was enough. If he had come back to the WWF when he was ready, it would have been interesting to see where they might have gone with him. So him and Iron Mike Sharp here, and Shane gets a monkey flip to start and a series of arm drags. Sharp is as loud as ever here in 1990. Like, you go back to like matches that I covered with him in 83 and 84, and I think he's even louder in these, and maybe it's because things are mic'd a little bit better. He ends up outside the ring, and Sharp comically falls on his back in the aisleway, and you can hear some kid laughing, which I got a real kick out of that when I heard that. And Shane, on an Irish whip, he puts his head down, a cardinal mistake for a ring veteran, but he gets out of the way when Sharp tries to kick him, so actually he probably didn't put his head down. Very, very smart move there. A series of elbows, but then Sharp gets the edge along the ropes, and Piper weighs in. Piper seems to want to weigh in on guys like on the ropes about not breaking clean. This is where he says, Iron Mike Sharp, this is where he's at his best. So I guess Iron Mike Sharp had something going for him in 1990. He was a good on the ropes sort of guy. But Sharp misses a drop kick. I don't think he's the kind of guy that should be doing drop kicks anyway. And Shane scores the victory with a really ugly crossbody off the top rope. It was not done particularly well. He kind of fell off him. I only give it 1.5 steamboats out of 10. But luckily, he'd be teaming with the Dragon in WCW soon, so he could learn the proper way to do a high crossbody off the top. Shane's generic rock music here. I've ripped Texas Tornado's music in the past and other sort of generic themes. It's just, it almost kind of sounds like in the beginning, like it's going to go into the Orient Express music. But then it kind of goes into a guitar riff and this and that kind of stuff. And Vince and Roddy make a reference again to Elvis's last performance being at the Market Square Arena, and says that Sharp was all shook up here. So, good, nice job there by Vince to cram his boy Elvis into yet another situation on WWF programming.
The World Wrestling Federation returns for a night of mega matches. Now, I've just learned here in the event center, there is also going to be a special appearance by the Gobbledygooker.
So there's another problem with the Gobbledygooker thing, is they couldn't agree on a pronunciation. You got Mooney here pronouncing it Gucker, which I don't know. It's Gobbledygooker, but it really doesn't matter for all the reasons that I went into. Mooney in the event center. We're looking at the Boston Garden Show for December 8th of 1990, which drew 8,000. So not the greatest attendance in the world for something that had a Hulk Hogan match on it, but the undercard was not exactly stacked at this time. Although you did have the Hart Foundation defending the tag team titles against Power and Glory. But beyond that, you have Tugboat and Dino Bravo, The Warlord and Jimmy Snuka, Marty Jannetty versus Demolition Smash. An interesting opening match, although at the time, you wouldn't have expected it. Rick Martel against Dustin Rhodes. And of course, they're promoting a Brother Love show featuring Jake the Snake Roberts that would also have an appearance by Rick the Model Martel as well. But another match on this show is something that you would see at the Royal Rumble in 1991, which was a shockingly great big man match. One of the better ones for WWF during the time period, and that would be the Big Boss Man going through the Heenan family one by one, and this time going against the Barbarian. So the Barbarian has a few things to say here, and when I hear them throw it to the Barbarian, they're like, okay, well, Heenan is going to talk here, and he's going to say everything for the Barbarian. But no, that is not the case. As Barbie, holy Lord, he actually, I swear to God, he cuts a decent promo, but I can't help but think of something else as he's doing it.
I do not like Boston, and I do not like Celtic, and I do not like you, Big Boss Man. I've been waiting for this for the longest time, and now the competition is coming. Bobby will be enjoying watching you screaming, and Big Boss Man, you and me, we're going to have some business.
I wonder if the Barbarian has ever listened to a Billy Joel album. That is one of the better Barbarian promos that I've ever heard in my life. Like, what is going on here? Then Heenan talks, and I like the Barbarian's part more than Heenan's part. Because Heenan, he does that thing where he calls it the Boston Gardens, which drives me up a wall. I've mentioned this in the past. It just drives me absolutely crazy. And then he refers to all the banners in the rafters of the Boston Garden, which there was a lot of them, mostly because of the Celtics' 16 NBA World Championships. But also, and this is something, I promise I'll be brief about this. In the old Garden, the Bruins had some sort of inferiority complex, even though they were the owner of the building and the Celtics were a tenant. The Celtics had all the championships up there, and the Bruins at the time only had 5 Stanley Cups. So to compensate for that, what they would do is they would run up a banner every time they would win a division title. And divisions in hockey were like 4 or 5 teams. And with the Bruins being an established franchise, they would win division titles, but obviously not winning the Stanley Cup later in the 70s and into the 80s, but they would win division titles. So rolling up these banners just made them look totally weak in comparison to the Celtics. It's kind of a bad thing. Although it's still not as bad as in Washington when they had the WNBA attendance champions banners at one time. And things haven't exactly picked up for the Wizards or the Capitals since then from a championship perspective. There's also a Jake the Snake Roberts promo. And this is during the period where he's wearing the contact lens to give the impression that he has somehow lost his eye or something from the Rick Martel spraying of arrogance at him on the Brother Love show. Luckily here, he is wearing sunglasses so we can actually focus on what he has to say.
Do not think for a moment, Brother Love, that you're leading a lamb, not an innocent one anyway, to slaughter in the Boston Garden. No, I know what to expect. I know Rick Martel's going to be in the building. But, Brother Love, you remember the DDT, don't you? So don't play no silly games, all right? You won't play none, I won't play none. As far as Martel goes, Martel, you're not playing games now, brother. You done stepped on the wrong thing. You pushed the wrong button, you see. And when you look at the evil in a man's face, brother, you gotta realize something. It's usually a little bit too late.
Thank you, Jake, for referring to it correctly as the Boston Garden and not in a plural sense there. Our next match is Tugboat taking on Jeff Sword. Very interesting sort of name. I'll get more into his backstory coming up because he had a history in other promotions like ICW, and his tag team partner from ICW is in a match coming up. But Vince can't help himself. He comments on the name.
Talking about unusual names. Jeff. Well, that's not so unusual, his first name, but his last name is Sword.
Jeff Sword.
Sword, like Zorro Sword, you know, like...
Sword.
Yeah.
All right, Vince, I don't know what Zorro is. It's Zorro. But it's kind of funny that he's making light of the name Jeff Sword while rolling out a character named the Gobbledygooker at roughly the same time. So I just want to point out that kind of cognitive dissonance there in Vince McMahon's thinking. Tugboat comes in and he does that thing to the camera, and I love how Vince just kind of no-sells it.
What if you were... Okay, whatever you say, Tug.
Yeah, whenever you hear the phrase, whatever you say, pal, or whatever you say, name, whatever... It's kind of like, all right, I'm done with you here. I'm not taking you seriously anymore. And so it was for Tugboat's push around this time. Of course, he was billed as Hulk Hogan's friend, and he helped to bring Hulk Hogan back into the fold with the letter-writing campaign and all that business. And then at the last second, he's off SummerSlam for mysterious reasons that I've gone into in the past, probably due to maybe getting a big head about his push. Who knows what it was, because it's never really been drawn out what the exact reason was. So why did Tugboat's push die, other than the fact that the character itself is just something that's completely ridiculous? Well, I'm going to point the finger at the fashion faux pas going on with Tugboat. And I'm not talking about the striped shirt that really makes him look fat, because the horizontal stripes there are not exactly slimming. They don't make him look good. And we all know Vince is very concerned about physiques. But it's the white pants after Labor Day. Yeah, that's not a thing anymore. Fashion senses have changed a lot in the last 25 to 30 years, where wearing white after Labor Day has become more commonplace, more acceptable in terms of fashion trends. But back then, for Tugboat to be wearing white pants for this show, which, as I said, taped late October, airing early December, really just kind of comes off as a faux pas. Perhaps he should have switched to a different color. Maybe red pants. Although, picture Tugboat wearing Shinsuke Nakamura's pants. They'd be like skin tight on him. And ugh, I don't want to see that. But Tuggers, he knows that his push is dying, so he's willing to do whatever it takes to impress Vince and impress me. And he gets over with me by doing a standing dropkick. Now, granted, it was not exactly, you know, 10 Okadas out of 10 there, but still, game respect game on that one. And but by the way, that's why the Usos wearing white pants on Survivor Series the other night, that's fine, because we're now in a different era. And also, they're more easily able to pull it off. So yeah, this is much more interesting than talking about what's going on in this match, which is a whole lot of nothing. Tugboat does finish with the splash here. And you get the theme music, of course. I'm surprised a hockey team hasn't instituted that as their goal horn. Maybe a minor league team has somewhere along the line. If you have like retro wrestling night or something of that sort, you could just play the Tugboat thing when the home team scores a goal. In fact, I'm kind of shocked that the Boston Bruins haven't incorporated that at some point, because whoever's in charge of the music at the Bruins home games is a real wrestling fan, because he's constantly playing not only like Real American, which is pretty generic at this point, but playing like the LOD theme, the Ultimate Warriors theme, Brock Lesnar's theme, even CM Punk's theme, which is more commercial music. But, you know, it just seems kind of strange. But, yes, I'm calling on some ECHL team out there for one night to have a retro wrestling night and to have the goal horn for that night be the tugboat horn and then the music afterwards. Back to the event center again. And first, we have the Rockers there, who call themselves the Thrill Seekers of the WWF. And somewhere up in Canada, Lance Storm and Chris Jericho have perked up and said, that sounds like a pretty good name there. I want to focus more on the second promo here, which is from one of my favorite big guys of the era, Earthquake. And he's doing that thing, of course, that he would always do, moving from side to side like a person who hasn't reached the 10,000 steps or 15,000 steps on their Fitbit for the day, so they're trying to cheat it as they're going to bed or something, and just kind of doing that thing, quickly back and forth. And Earthquake's promo is really strange here, because the way he phrases something is kind of funny to me.
Thousands and thousands of the Hulkamaniacs are going to be screaming, but then that's where the Earthquake takes over.
Hulk Hogan! Hi again, it's the Earthquake!
It sounds like Earthquake is leaving a voicemail for Hogan or something.
Hi again, it's the Earthquake!
Yeah, give me a call back at Klondike 53227. Couple things I want to go over with you, Hulk. Alright, thanks. Bye. Anyway. Power and Glory up next here, taking on Dan Robbins and Alan Reynolds. And Power and Glory, of course, I've mentioned this in the past, I think in passing, because I don't know if they've ever actually been on the show, because I haven't done 1990 WWF, and I don't think they've been on any of the 1991 shows. They were really derailed by a better option in the Nasty Boys coming along. As I had mentioned earlier on the house show at the Boston Garden, they're facing off against the Hart Foundation. So they're in title matches at this point, and perhaps the thought was that eventually, they could get the tag titles, but when the Nasty Boys become available, they make more sense because they're a fresher product. They haven't been around for as long as those two guys have. There are limits to repackaging you can do with guys. And with somebody like Paul Roma, where he'd been at the bottom of the card almost since like 1984 and 85 straight on, and with Hercules, who had pushes derailed from time to time, and some of his in-ring work was not particularly great. He was never a truly great promo. And also, they're there with Slick, and there's a lot that I like about Slick as a manager. He's fun, he's a memorable character and all that, but he's the third manager at best in the WWF, and in fact, you could even make an argument that he ranks below even Fuji, because Fuji had managed tag team champions in the past in Demolition. Slick never had a champion. And yeah, while it took Heenan a long time to have a champion in the Heenan family, there's obvious, I mean, Heenan was above all of that. It was really because Heenan didn't even need a champion in the family. And Power and Glory were part of the Visionaries team that survived intact at the Survivor Series that year and making it to the final match of survival in the 5-on-3 match there with Hogan, the Warrior, Tito Santana versus the whole Visionaries team, which was Rick Martel, Warlord, Power and Glory, and, of course, Ted DiBiase. A match which, you know, they had to rush through everything on the Survivor Series. And part of the reason why the gobbledygooker thing lasted so long was to give Tito Santana a bit of a blow before he had to come back out there for the final match. But in thinking of that match as a concept, the best part of it is nothing to do with the match itself. I'll get to the worst part of it in just a moment. The best part of it is the pre-match promo with Hulk Hogan, the Ultimate Warrior, and Tito Santana, as the Warrior lays out the I don't even know how to put this. He talks about Warrior Wildness, Hulkamania, and then when he gets to Tito, he calls it Arriba Dirce, which is just the absolute greatest thing that the Ultimate Warrior ever said. You could take that final promo from 2014 Raw and all the deep, meaningful things that he might have said. You can shove those, okay? Because Arriba Dirce is the greatest thing that the Ultimate Warrior ever said. Now, the worst part about that match is the Powerplex was a great finishing move and certainly the best thing that Power and Glory had going for it, with the superplex by Hercules, and then right as the guy hits the mat, it was timed in such a way that Roma would come off with a splash off the top rope. Really cool move. But they do it on Hulk Hogan here, and it gets summarily buried as he does the strong kick out and recovers right away. And that is not particularly helpful for a tag team like that. Yeah, I guess it's cool that they got to hit their move on Hogan, but you could never really look at it the same way again, at least from my perspective here. Double underhook suplex by Roma in this match, and he follows it up with a nice drop kick. Roma did have a pretty good drop kick. I give this one, so what did I score this? A 7.8 Okadas out of 10. And yeah, I don't know if what it was then. Maybe Hercules was the problem here, but Roma, in his interview with Steve Austin, which was a while ago on the Steve Austin show, because, you know, I was actually listening to Austin's podcast. That's how long ago that was. Hercules was a nice guy and a mentor backstage, but, you know, he had just been there for too long. He'd come in late 1985, and here we are 5 years later. He's just kind of bouncing along from one thing to another. Starts out as a heel, then he has the babyface run, which starts out strong, and then it fades pretty quickly after WrestleMania 5 and the whole Heenan story ends. And then you turn him back heel against the Rockers, they heat up again, but as I said, the better option in the Nasty Boys came along. Powerplex finishes in this match, so you're not going to get any strong kickouts from either Robbins or Reynolds here. And Slick, I like when Slick would talk to the camera, and he quotes Dandy Don Meredith from the old Monday Night Football days of the 70s with his famous line from the end of Blowout Games.
Paul Roma! Party over!
Turn off the lights, the party's over. They say that all good things must end. Call it a night, the party's over, and tomorrow and next year starts the same old thing again. Yeah.
And speaking of football, you get a promo here for the Royal Rumble, and those two are connected because the Royal Rumble that year was held on a Saturday night, which is done to avoid the conference championship games for the NFL that time, which were being held on the same weekend. There was no bye week between the conference championships and the Super Bowl in that particular year. It's one of the few times that the NFL has ever done that, and certainly one of the few times that they ever did it on purpose. And it's funny because still at that time, they were not having their pay-per-views on Sunday nights in general. WrestleMania was still something that would start at 4 in the afternoon on Sunday. Royal Rumble in 89, I know, started at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I remember it not being a night show in 1990. Here on a Saturday night in 1991. And I did not get the pay-per-view, because as I said, I was still out, and maybe I felt burned after Survivor Series and the giant egg. But I remember one thing that drew me back in, which was something that's really something that would never happen nowadays, which was I picked up the newspaper that we got the next day. The Boston Herald would often print results of wrestling, whether at the Boston Garden or even for a pay-per-view the day after. And I saw Sergeant Slaughter defeated the Ultimate Warrior for the WWF World title, and I said, whoa, I've got to see this. And then that is when I started watching again, because I saw that little note in the newspaper that the Ultimate Warrior had lost the title. If there's one regret I have on the shows that I've done, it's that with regard to the Brother Love show, which is up next here, it is not something that I've done a lot of the big Brother Love shows, like Boss Man attacking Hogan, Earthquake attacking Hogan, Savage cutting Brutus Beefcake's hair. I haven't gotten to as many of those because the episodes during the Brother Love era are fairly spotty until you get to late 1990 and you see more of them out there on YouTube. I'm hoping at some point that will change and that more stuff will be available, because there are certain Brother Love shows, even like minor ones, that I would love to go in depth on. Now, this one here is Hacksaw Jim Duggan, and he comes out with his 2x4 and American flag together, and he's got yellow ribbons on the 2x4, which at the time period was a symbol of support our troops. Yellow ribbons have lots of different meanings all over the world, and that was the meaning at that time for that. It's also, you know, you have the pink ribbon for breast cancer awareness. The yellow ribbon is the color ribbon for endometriosis, which I did not know, but okay, that's fine. It's probably the most famous for the song Tie a Yellow Ribbon Round the Old Oak Tree by Tony Orlando and Dawn from the early 1970s. And the yellow ribbon around the oak tree was to symbolize a prisoner coming back to his family, and they would tie a yellow ribbon to indicate that the guy was welcome back. And if there was no ribbon, he would stay on the bus or whatever. So that's kind of the multi-meanings there of the yellow ribbon. So Duggan comes out, and if you're expecting a nuanced promo about the goings-on in the Middle East and the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait at the time, you're not really going to get it from Hacksaw Jim Duggan, or as Brother Love called him, Dugan. So apparently the Bill Watts influence has bled over into Bruce Pritchard a little bit, and Vince immediately corrects him there. And Duggan talks about recession, which I thought was interesting, as the recession in the United States had started and would last, well, its effects would last into 1992, but from the GDP metrics, it was over in the middle of 1991. It was a result of mostly of loss of consumer confidence, with consumer spending being such a large portion of the gross domestic product in the United States. When consumer confidence dips, as it did after the oil shocks, which Duggan also mentions, at $2 a gallon gas at that time, which was pretty much unheard of, you had a reduction in spending, which caused a dip in GDP, but it recovered fairly quickly. It was a very minor recession, but it took a while for jobs to come back. You still had unemployment rate in the mid-sevens in 1992, which is partly what caused George H.W. Bush to lose re-election in 1992 to Bill Clinton.
I see Iraqi and Iraqis desecrating our flag, chanting death to America.
I can't fact-check everything Duggan might have seen on television or thought he saw on TV at that time, but the phrase death to America is a very distinctly Iranian phrase coming out of the Iranian Revolution in 1979. And Iran and Iraq were not exactly pals. They had an 8-9 year war that they were just coming off of at that point. So I highly doubt that Iraqis were desecrating the flag and all of that. And even putting that aside, in the Ayatollah, Khomeini, he was dead by this point, but he made it a point to have it so that the death to America chants were not taking place on radio or television so much, but during like rallies, during the house show rallies, for the Ayatollah, if I may put it that way. So I don't want to get into the whole causes of the first Iraq war. Let me just simplify it as Iraq invaded Kuwait because they owed Kuwait a lot of money coming out of the Iran-Iraq war, and they owed them a ton of money and offered basically a fraction of the sum to Kuwait to pay off the debts. They decided to say no to Iraq, so the invasion happens. And then the thought was, well, is Saudi Arabia next? And that's why you have an international coalition there called Operation Desert Shield, leading up to Operation Desert Storm, which started pretty much around the time of the 1991 Royal Rumble. Now, Duggan goes in on Sergeant Slaughter here. It's a very interesting change in terminology from what you remember Slaughter being, the Iraqi traitor. Here, Slaughter is referred to as a mercenary because that character started out as someone who felt America had become weak because we were cheering for Nikolai Volkov, which, by the way, he had a good point that we were cheering for Volkov without, you know, thinking, can we really trust this guy? What, just because he turns on Boris Zhukov, that's enough to say, all right, we'll welcome in Nikolai Volkov with open arms? Slaughter did have a point there. But he's referred to as a mercenary rather than a traitor, which is a very different term, because the word traitor has a different connotation to it entirely. I do like how Duggan calls the manager General Eggnog. I don't think he says it on purpose, but it sounds like he says General Eggnog. And Slaughter, at the Survivor Series, had a pretty interesting performance in one of my favorite bad matches of all time. It by no means is it a good match. It's completely rushed because of the time they needed for the match of survival at the end. This would be Slaughter's Mercenaries, which was comprised of him, Boris Zhukov, and the Orient Express facing off against the Alliance, led by Nikolai Volkov, Tito Santana, and the Bolsheviks in one of the most pro wrestling matches ever. And I put pro wrestling in parentheses there because it is what it's all about. Let's take the two sides of that match here. You have a Croatian guy who's really from Baltimore pretending to be a displaced Soviet, who then would claim he's from Lithuania later on. You have a Mexican who's really from New Jersey. You have two guys, the Bushwhackers, you know, billed from New Zealand. And on the other side, you have a mercenary who is siding with Iraq, who is managed by a guy who actually is from Iraq and actually looks like the leader of Iraq from that time, Saddam Hussein. You have the Orient Express, billed from Japan, one of whom is from Japan, but the other, you get the more common Japanese, where he's actually from Hawaii, even though he's billed from Japan. And then there's Boris Zhukov, a Soviet guy who is actually from the state of Virginia. There's nothing as quintessential pro wrestling as that. And the three guys who are with Slaughter get pinned like in record time, I think within like 3 minutes. And Slaughter just kind of slowly fights his way back, getting pins with clotheslines, because that's how Survivor Series worked at that time. And you get him with Tito at the end. You get the ref bump. And Adnan just kind of comes into the ring and nails Tito with the flag. And you get the cockamamie referee taps Slaughter 3 times on the shoulder when he's got Tito in the camel clutch. Howard Finkel's memorable announcement, which he just starts out with, "Sergeant Slaughter has been disqualified," leading to Tito Santana as the sole survivor of the match. And I really enjoy that match, even though it's completely terrible. There's almost no artistic or intrinsic value to it. It kind of makes that 1990 Survivor Series memorable just for the lineups on the two sides. And it was really nice to see Tito Santana get a break because he hadn't had too much going on for him in the previous couple of years. So it was nice to see him get to the match of survival and for the Ultimate Warrior to outline once and for all what was Arrivederci. Next bout, Superfly Jimmy Snuka. Yes, here late in 1990, still getting time on TV, facing off against Doug Vines, who was the tag team partner of Jeff Sword. I like that there was a team of Sword and Vines there. I feel like a turn would be Sword cutting up Vines. But anyway, they were tag team in ICW, the Angelo Poffo promotion, in the early 1980s. I actually saw some footage of them from 1981 on a YouTube video as I was just kind of going around looking for stuff on there. And they did win the USWA tag titles in 1991. So there was still some success going forward here, just kind of breezing through a WWF taping in Indiana, just doing a quick job here. Probably did the challenge tapings, you know, either the day before or the day after. So nice little payday for them. Much more notable than Jimmy Snuka, who, you know, we all know what he is. Jimmy Hart joins on commentary, so now we have a three-man booth. So this is the end of, really, Vince and Roddy as a two-man booth, because the next week, the Honky Tonk Man would join Vince and Roddy on commentary for a very ill-advised team. There was no chemistry there between them, as Piper hated Honky Tonk Man and was willing to let people know whenever that topic came up. Piper asked Jimmy if all the 976 numbers were busy, and that's why he was here. If, for those of you who don't know, who are too young to know what 976 numbers were, a lot of sex hotlines were put on a 976 thing because it was a pay grade, and they were very high, kind of like the 900 numbers that we would come to know, but they were more like local calls. You would call them for sports scores, which is something that seems so weird these days when you can look anything up on their phone. I was trying to think of what the most interesting thing was about 1990 Jimmy Snuka, and I couldn't really come up with anything other than his WrestleMania match and Steve Allen ripping on him for his tights and saying that his wife has underwear like that. That's pretty much the only Jimmy Snuka from that year that I can even refer to. So Jimmy's there, and he talks about all of his great selling albums.
I had more than one, guys. I'm telling you right now, I had 3 million seller albums, and you know it, and I do too, man.
What were they?
What do you mean, Keep On Dancing, Keep On Dancing 1, Keep On Dancing 2, and the greatest hits of Keep On Dancing?
Keep On Dancing was the one hit song by Jimmy Hart's band, The Gentrys, which reached number 4 on the charts in 1965. They had follow-ups that charted in the bottom half of the Billboard 100, but never quite rose to the same prominence as that one song. So kind of funny that he would refer to it as Keep On Dancing 1, Keep On Dancing 2, and so on. So they get back to talking about Snuka. And Vince McMahon, I know he wasn't thinking of it at the time, but when you take the whole of Snuka's life and career into perspective, what he says here is an extremely ill-advised choice of words.
You know, Snuka's not bad. He's got a lot of good moves. He's quick. He's fast. But, you know, he just doesn't have that killer instinct, man.
He what?
To me, that's the one thing he does have, is the killer instinct.
Oh, dear God, no. I can't believe that made it out there. And Piper's little laugh there in the middle, like he knew where this was going. Because Piper's not around in 1983 when the whole Nancy Argentino thing goes down. But, you know, it was kind of a big story within wrestling circles and all of Snuka's issues. But, oh my God. And for Vince to say, yes, he most certainly does have the killer instinct. What do you know, Vince? And tell me, what do you know and when did you know it? I think somebody in Allentown might like to speak with you, or Hamburg, or wherever. There are some detectives that would like to have a word with you about Jimmy Snuka's killer instinct there. God, it feels like they were saying that on purpose, like they knew what was going on. This is a complete cover-up. I'm blowing the lid off this case right now. Illuminati confirmed. Splash gets the win for Snuka here. The splash was always over for him, even if he wasn't winning too many matches other than these squash matches over enhancements on the weekly TV. So, yeah, a win for Jimmy Snuka, but he may have been incriminated by the commentary here. If I was a relief pitcher in Major League Baseball, that would be my walk-in song when I'm coming in from the bullpen. It's Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap. Anyway, the Orient Express in their original incarnation of Tanaka and Sato taking on Albert Bissell and Gary Jackson, who have no introduction here. It's kind of disappointing. I feel like I'm watching an NWA show from 1988 where they're rushing through everything. But Gary Jackson, this is something he has on his resume that sounds more impressive than it is. He held the NWA Missouri title for over a year in 2002 and 2003 when it really didn't matter anymore. And also, the title had been vacant for 16 years since Harley Race vacated it when he jumped to the WWF. So he just kind of held on to the title, and then it appears like he never lost it. He vacated it at some point. Yeah, NWA stuff after a certain point in time, it's best to just really stop paying attention. So this is near the end of the line for the Orient Express, this edition. Sato was going to step aside in favor of Kato, as Lord Al Hayes would refer to him. I'm looking at Sato, and I said, boy, you know, how old was he at this point anyway? And then I look it up, and he's a year younger than I am right now. So once again, I have made that mistake and made that correlation, just as I did with Tony Garea many episodes ago. These two guys did not look good in the Mercenaries team, and I tried to explain it to myself in kayfabe. I mean, they're both out in 4 or 5 minutes. I think that they were so embarrassed to be next to Slaughter. Yes, they're Japanese, but Japan provided monetary support to the Persian Gulf effort in Operation Desert Shield, so they didn't want to be seen next to Slaughter. They just got their check and got the hell out of there. And plus, he made them paint their faces up with the camouflage and then stand there as Slaughter cuts that really long promo as his music plays with the drum thing, like, I, Sergeant Slaughter, salute one flag, and that is the banner of that brave Iraqi nation. I would have wanted to get out of there, too. So, good job by the Orient Express just to, you know, take their pinfalls and get out. They're talking here about them being punished for an incident that had happened on Superstars about 3 weeks earlier in a match against the Legion of Doom, where Demolition interfered, and that now Demolition would only be two members, and we have more on that coming up, but that the Orient Express would have to team with Mr. Fuji to face the LOD. It seems like a weird punishment to have a handicap match and give the team that you're punishing the advantage. But I guess the idea there is that you're punishing Fuji, even though it had been done before at WrestleMania 5. And the Orient Express, by any measure, is a lesser team than the Powers of Pain were in early 1989. And LOD, kind of on the same level as Demolition. They had, of course, not won the tag team titles yet. But I can't find that match anywhere on record, so who knows when they might have done that. Maybe it was on a house show and all that. They asked Jimmy Hart on commentary, because he's still there, he's going to hang around, what does Earthquake eat on his diet?
What does Earthquake eat? What is his diet? Just out of curiosity.
Matter of fact, I mean,
well, I hope you know he weighs 469 pounds, and I'm going to let him put on an extra 20 pounds. How do you like that?
So does Roseanne Barr. That don't mean nothing. What does he eat?
What's the diet? What's the training regimen? Ah, I see. Okay, secret. Keep it a mystery. Uh-huh. Huh? Yeah.
Well, it wouldn't be a secret for long, because at WrestleMania 7, Regis Philbin let us all in that the secret diet of Earthquake is pizza, as he told a story about him hijacking the Pizza Hut delivery truck, tipping it over, and eating everything in sight. Regis, you're beautiful. Sato picks up the win here with a sit-out powerbomb, which is pretty original for WWF in 1990. Gotta say, you know, if he's saying goodbye, he's going out in style, although Sato would make one random appearance as a wrestler. Yes, he would have many non-wrestling appearances down the road that I'm sure I'll cover in a future show. one random appearance at the SummerSlam Spectacular in 1991 for the only time they had the three-man Orient Express of Kato, Sato, and Tanaka. One final event center to promote the Boston Garden Show. And we have Demolition, now only Smash and Crush. But now with Mr. Fuji back as manager, Crush wouldn't even make the show. As I mentioned, it was Marty Jannetty versus Smash on that card. Crush had some sort of injury which kept him out of shows for a little while after that. And Fuji is back as the manager of Demolition. I used to have a real problem with Fuji coming back to Demolition after only 2 years, given the way that they dumped him. But when you really think about it, and I kind of invented a kayfabe story for why Fuji would be allowed back in the fold here. Yes, they were mad at him, but time heals all wounds, and I think that it was Axe who had the real problem with Fuji, who wasn't so crazy about it. So I invented this scenario where Axe left and decided to be the one to leave because he had a bigger problem with Fuji than either of the other guys. Of course, they were really well on to the back nine of their run in the WWF as a team. I think they had just holed out on 16, maybe teeing off on 17 at this time. It's just not a lot going on for them going forward. I mean, by WrestleMania 7, they're losing that random match that's a make-good to the SWS partnership to the team of Tenryu and Kitao. So, just kind of really strange there. But that was at least my kayfabe explanation for why Fuji would have been allowed back. And maybe Smash was feeling desperate. You know, he needed to pay the bills. Somebody was going to come repo his car. And perhaps that might have given him an idea going forward. There was also a tugboat promo as well.
You know, Dino Bravo, you remind me of the barnacles on the hull of a ship. You're just along for the ride. That's right, brother. You're the lowest thing in the WWF.
Oh, so he's clearly seen Dino Bravo matches. I just wanted to see what it would sound like stacking nine tugboat noises back to back to back and all that. And it's really unpleasant, and I want to apologize for that. I probably should edit that out, but I'm not going to. So they wrap up. They show Piper and Jimmy Hart and Vince at the broadcast area. And Jimmy is wearing a very colorful jacket, as he was wont to do. And it has keyboard keys along like the lapel of the coat. And Piper and Vince just grab him, and they start mashing on the keys like they're playing a piano, and it plays a sound. But something really bothers me about this entire thing. You can see Vince and Piper hitting the same area of the jacket twice in succession, but it's making completely different noises.
In episode 2F09, when Ichi plays Scratchy's skeleton like a xylophone, he strikes the same rib twice in succession, yet he produces two clearly different tones. I mean, what are we, to believe that this is some sort of a magic xylophone or something? Boy, I really hope somebody got fired for that blunder.
Yeah, I think that might be a decent place to leave off for this week. Awful lot happening. Kind of a bit of a big show here this week, and it's got nothing to do with Paul White. But we're not done here, as we have a quick edition of YouTube Comment Theater. And, you know, there's a moderate number of comments for this. Some of them I can't read, because one of them I actually reported because I was mildly offended by it, and I don't even want to get into that. So we'll start out here with Mark Mullins. Kane made his debut at Survivor Series 1990, and Kane also made his debut at Bad Blood 1997, attacking his own brother Kane. So, yeah, of course. Well, you know, they brought back the name. They obviously had a thing for the name Kane, and once they dropped it from Undertaker, like, maybe we should use that again. Doc the Metal Freak says, the Ultimate Warrior back then proved he was the most original, most electrifying man in sports entertainment. Yeah, with all the lightning bolts and lasers and all that. It was just really, really weird considering that they were just about to give up on him. KLCT 2006 says, audio sweetened for the gooker as we booed the hell out of him in Hartford that night. And yeah. But again, I'm not as offended by that as they did with the Royal Rumble 1992, because they were not actively trying to change the fate of two guys and, you know, a whole storyline. They're just completely different. It's really apples and oranges. And finally, Fists of Stank says, Texas Tornado, master of the partial arts. I saw that. I'm like, that's going on last. Master of the partial art. I'm sorry. There's been an awful lot of Kerry Von Erich jokes that I've seen over time. I approve of some. I don't approve of others. And I don't want to make light of the guy. You know, I don't like to talk about his drug problem or anything like that. But master of the partial art. That's a good one. All right, that'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. Now, for next week's show, I very much wanted to do something that involved a certain wrestling trope. And there was a show that I had decided on, and I decided not to go with that, not because it was also a WWF show, but because it is literally the same date as when this show aired, but in a different year. So I figured to avoid confusion, I'll hold that off for another time. Plus, the complete show is not on YouTube, so I'll defer to a later date. I do have it in the strategic reserve somewhere that if I had to review it, if YouTube went totally dark, I would be able to do that. But for next week, we're going to go back to 1986 and Jim Crockett Promotions. And I've not gone that early in NWA WCW. I think the earliest I've gone is 1988, so a little bit of an oversight by me there. And there are a lot of star power on that show next week. Some of it in the form of promos. You have Magnum TA, you have Tully Blanchard on that episode of NWA Worldwide from March 29th, 1986. But we also have the Midnight Express, the Condrey Eaton version. Jimmy Garvin, the aforementioned Jimmy Garvin from earlier in this show at the Shane Douglas Trunks issue. A Ron Garvin squash, as called by David Crockett. I can't wait to get into that. And Arn Anderson closes out the show. But for all those guys being name people, the highlight of our show next week is between Pez Whatley and Jimmy Valiant. And Jimmy Valiant makes a very key mistake and says something that sets Pez Whatley off and leads to what is undoubtedly the most hilarious haircut angle of all time. So do join me next week for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
The one thing he does have is the killer instinct. Superfly Jimmy Snuka.